In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
There are two things I have never understood. Democrats who think they're for small businesses, and small business owners who believe that Democrats are for small businesses. Just look at the evidence. Here in Oregon, Democrats just passed the Punish Small Business Tax. If Oregon's Democrat Attorney General has her way, every business will have to start collecting sales tax for other states, which will hit small businesses especially hard. And every business, small or large, will soon have to pay more to bail out years of Democrat overspending on PERS. Elected Democrats are out of control. The only way the Democrats in Salem are ever going to stop punishing the little guy and the rest of us is to elect a Republican governor. Even if you're a Democrat, you have to elect a Republican this year. You have to send a message, enough is enough. The only way to do that is to get a Republican through the primary who can beat Kate Brown in November. In a general election, you vote for the candidate who best reflects your values and whom you think will do the best job for the state. In a primary, it's a very different strategy. In a primary, the person you should vote for is the one you think can give your side the best chance of winning in November. Your best to beat their best. And that's what I hope listeners of iSpy Radio do. Look at the choices and then think, who on my side can beat Kate Brown? A listener forwarded me a flyer that Newt Bueller just sent out, not to Republicans, but to members of the Independent Party. The first paragraph reads, compassionate, pro-choice, pro-marriage equality, medical doctor. We'll post that flyer on this week's show page on iSpyRadio.com so you can see it for yourself. If Newt wins the primary, yes, I will absolutely vote for him in November. But I know a lot of my fellow Republicans won't vote for him because he's pro-choice, nearly a Democrat, hates Trump, and all the rest. That's why I won't vote for Newt in the primary, because I'm not convinced he can win against Kate. But we have two Republican candidates who can. We talked with Sam Carpenter last week. This week, I'd like to welcome Captain Greg Wooldridge back to the show. He is a three-time commander of the Blue Angels and Naval Base Commander. Greg, it's good to talk to you again.
It's great to be back with you. This is such a wonderful opportunity.
Listeners continue to write us and tell us good things about you and your campaign. And then just this week, there was some surprising news. Bruce Cuff suddenly stepped out of the race and endorsed you. It's frankly too bad he didn't do it before the deadline, because he'll still show up on the ballot. But that's got to be good news for you and give you some momentum as you head into the final stretch.
It's fantastic. Bruce actually got about 11% of the vote the last time he ran. And he was running strong, really strong this year, this cycle. And to get that kind of support from his base, to me, wow, that's a game changer. We're surging with that. That's great news.
Well, that's cool. You know, the other candidates, both Carpenter and Bueller, are citing polls that have them in the lead in the primary. Do you guys have any polling showing where you're at?
We had only the straw polls that we've been part of. We haven't taken any polls ourselves. We saw a couple numbers. We don't agree with them in many cases. And we know that our moving forward as fast as we are right now with Bruce joining up and then and still going out and getting out and hitting the media pretty hard is surging us forward. We're
good.
We're very optimistic.
Well, so as you're out there meeting with groups, and I know that you have been all over the state, what are some of the complaints that you're hearing directly from voters about Oregon?
A lot of it has to do with how encumbered they are by state regulations and state laws and how they can't access our beautiful natural resources to create those family wage jobs and to bring success back to the ONC lands in southern and western Oregon that have been for so long held back from them, where they used to get tremendous support for their schools and public safety. That's down to about 10% of what it was. We've got to change that. I hear that a lot, a worry about schools, about education, why we're doing so poorly in graduation rates. And of course, the small business aspect of it, and the way that Governor Brown signed that bill through that took away the Senate Bill 1528 that took away the tax break that had been made available by Congress, having the IRS rewrite their laws. So,
yes, and
you know, there's just a plethora of things that people aren't satisfied with.
Well, in fact, that's one of the things we want to talk to you about. And in case people weren't aware of what exactly happened, this is a new law that Governor Kate Brown just signed a month ago when she and the Democrat-controlled legislature decided to take away a special tax break that was in Trump's tax plan that was specifically designed to benefit small businesses. What it did was it disconnects Oregon small businesses from the tax break that Trump had just given them. In that tax plan, small businesses could deduct 20% of the income passed through right off the bat. And the way that it would work essentially is if that business had $100,000 of taxable income when it passed through to the owner, they could lop off 20%, so that they would only have to pay tax on $80,000. But of course, now thanks to Governor Kate Brown, Oregonians won't get that. Let's talk about what that means to small businesses. I mean, you were a naval commander. What would it have meant if all of your enlisted men had gotten a 20% tax break? Or more to the point, what would they have done to you if your admiral had given it to them, but then you had taken it away?
They had tried to get me fired, I'm sure. You know,
or worse.
That would have never happened. I would have never done that. I want people to be able to, you know, engage in growth. And that's what small businesses in Oregon need to have available to them. Their margins are very, very slim to begin with. And then to take away this opportunity to recapitalize in the mom and pop businesses, and even up to, I think it was up to $300,000,
yeah,
that they could have taken that tax break with to recapitalize. And by doing so, also creating jobs. And that's what we need. You know, small businesses account for about 80% of the non-governmental economy in the state. That's a lot. That's a mighty force. And if we can let that blossom with those opportunities, instead of now taking $250 million away from them, my goodness, what kind of a decision was that? That's not the right thing to do.
Yeah, it drives me crazy that for some reason it is wrong that people actually keep their own money that they earned. Let's go and take a break there. Everyone knows that Oregon doesn't have a sales tax, except we do, on cars and healthcare providers. Mm-hmm. Worse, if Oregon's attorney general gets her way, Oregon businesses will soon be collecting sales tax for other states. Stay tuned. More with Captain Greg Wooldridge, Republican candidate for governor, after this. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Republican candidate for governor, Captain Greg Wooldridge. He is a former naval commander, and also he was a commander of the Blue Angels. And so I want to talk to you now about this internet sales tax that is coming up. We had talked about this a couple weeks ago. People want to find out more about that, they can head to iSpyRadio.com. Just look on our archives page. You can get the podcast and a whole lot more there. But just in brief, the internet sales tax is a tax on goods or services sold over the internet and collected for states, counties, cities, townships, and villages that all have their own sales tax, from as much as, you know, 5%, 6%, 7%, 8% to as little as 0.1%. Sales tax used to be only collected for a state or taxing entity if you had a physical presence in that jurisdiction. Now, thanks to the internet sales tax that is before the Supreme Court right now, if it is upheld, any Oregon business, small or large, that sells goods or services over the internet will suddenly have to collect sales tax for all of those entities, all 12,000 of them. This will hit small businesses especially hard because they don't have teams of lawyers and accountants to deal with all of those compliance issues. Greg, this is shocking, but perhaps more so that Oregon's own attorney general is in favor of this. She signed an amicus brief in favor of this sales tax. Were you aware of this, and what do you think one way or the other?
I was aware of it on the periphery. Attorney General Rosenblum needs to get a grip. You know, it seems like Democrats have never seen a tax they didn't like.
Yeah, yes.
And to do this, once again, just like Senate Bill 1528, once again, they're reaching into the pockets where they think there's a little excess money. And in small business, there's no excess money. Too slim are the margins for these entrepreneurs, these brave souls, they get out there day in and day out and have to go back to the ledger and say, how are we doing? How are we doing? Are we making it? That's courage. And to have state government jump in their way and take this away from them, my goodness, you know, come on, folks. We've got to do better for Oregonians. This is not the way it should work.
Absolutely. You know, Trump's economy is growing, and a lot of states are building on what Trump is doing and making good economic decisions. Consumer confidence is at an 18-year high, but it seems so many, and as we look across the landscape here, Oregon is just going backwards. I mean, we're punishing job creators. It just seems to me the only way to send a message to the Democrats in Salem is to elect a Republican governor. So let's say that you get elected. How do you convince the Democrats there in the legislature to stop punishing small businesses?
First, right off the bat, I have the veto pen. So it's going to make them think. It's going to make them think a little more about, you know, and the Republicans and Democrats will get together instead of the Democrats just bullying their way through and then having a carte blanche, a Kate Blanche, if you will, opportunity there in the head office. That's got to quit. When I become governor, I'll have that veto pen. I'll talk to folks. I'll say, look, we got to do better than this. And it'll be persuasive and, you know, hopefully inspirational on what we can do for Oregonians and not to reach into their pockets and into their desktops to make them give more. We've got to knock off some of these boutique projects that we develop and also let Dennis Richardson continue to mine through his auditor-in-chief role, mine those areas within the agencies that money is being wasted and perhaps even fraudulently wasted. You know, we've got to keep going after that so we don't have to raise taxes to pay for things. We can recover it in efficiencies and the proper use of our wonderful treasury we get from Oregonians. We've got to use it properly.
Absolutely. One of the other things that came up in our discussions from a couple of weeks ago with economist Jonathan Williams of ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, is this ticking time bomb that we have with PERS. I mean, nobody seems to know how much Oregon owes PERS. I mean, estimates of the shortfall are anywhere from 25 to 50 to 100 billion, even $200 billion. And we have this shortfall because Oregon lawmakers, beginning back in the 1990s, so Republicans are to blame for this too, began to promise these huge elaborate pensions to our state employees. And while nobody seems to agree on how much we owe, everybody does seem to agree that we can't ignore this any longer. So what are some of your solutions to fixing PERS?
PERS is definitely the elephant in the room. It's damaging education when 35% of an education budget goes to PERS to pay retirements. That's not helping at all. And the infrastructure. So yes, PERS is a huge problem. I'll attack it the first week I'm in office. First of all, I hope I'm not eligible for PERS, but if I am, I'll go right into this new program where each new hire will be doing a dedicated and defined contribution instead of getting a defined benefit. So we'll start a 401k type program. I think most people are talking about that as one of the solutions. That will really help. That will, over time, reduce that unfunded obligation and bring it down. There are some other things. There's a good guy running for governor as well, Brett Hyland, who has a great idea that when I get elected, I'm going to bring him onto the scene to help with that. You know, there's ways we've got to get it paid down. We've got to get it paid down. We've got to stop that, the continuing burgeoning of that unfunded liability. We've got to stop it, and we will. The 401k type program will help, but there may be some other ways that we can do that.
What about the existing current retirees' pension plans? Is there anything that can be done about those?
Well, you know what? I'm going to leave that up to the majority lawmakers in the legislature. There is another way to do that. I'm going to let them make that call.
Well, they are the ones that got us into this mess.
That's kind of foggy, but I want to keep it that way for now. Okay. There's a way it can be done. It's not going to make people happy, but it may have to happen, and we'll see.
Well, we definitely cannot continue the way that we've been going. So let's go ahead and take a break there. You know, even in crazy California, cities are rejecting the state sanctuary law that their governor and legislature imposed on them. But did you know that in Oregon, it is also a sanctuary state thanks to our governor and legislature? Well, you can help put it on the ballot so voters can decide. Head to StopOregonSanctuaries.org. Print, sign, mail. It is that easy. That's StopOregonSanctuaries.org. Do it today. And welcome back. We're talking today to Greg Wooldridge. He is a three-time commander of the Blue Angels and went on to turn around a failing Navy base to make it the top naval base in the world. Very much like being a CEO of a company with 8,000 employees. You can find out more about Captain Greg Wooldridge at his website, wooldridgefororegon.com, and also on his Facebook page, or follow him on Twitter. We'll put all of that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. So we have been talking about some of these financial issues, and of course, PERS is just one part of a much larger and horrible puzzle, unfortunately. And that's really this massive spending problem that we have. We would have a lot more money to pay off PERS and our debt there if we weren't spending so much on other things. I mean, what are some other areas that need cutting?
Well, there's a lot of waste that goes on, and that's where Dennis Richardson, the Secretary of State, has found ways that we can economize and do things better. And instead of just folding those findings back into the agencies, he's made them public so we can hold people accountable. And that's what you do with leadership. You build those expectations, and then you can create accountability. But you have to have expectations. So where are the other wasteful areas? I think in education, there are some areas where we could do better. Good question.
Well, I think one of the things that really needs to happen, and I had said this last week, is that Oregon Democrats don't like to cut spending any more than they like to cut trees. But I think that's really the answer, and it really goes back to our heritage here in Oregon. Oregon can really flip the direction of the flow of money. Last year, we spent $1 billion to fight fires that didn't need to happen instead of cutting those trees and harvesting them, as we're required to do under state law. I would imagine that that's something that you would like to see turned around.
Absolutely. We need to get the forest floors cleaned up. There's a lot of usable stuff there that we could pull out, and that would certainly help in the fire problem, the spreading of the fires as fast as they spread. Clean that stuff up. You know, work with the federal government and get the State Department of Forestry. Get them fired up, no pun intended. Get them cranked up to get these things done for all of Oregon and spend our money wisely in how we do that. If the feds, the BLM or the Department of Forestry nationwide, if the federal government doesn't want to act on it, I'll go back to Washington and I'll talk to Greg Walden and the other representatives of this great state and we'll get some action.
Well, we have certainly got to start opening up those lands again, because it's state law that we're supposed to be harvesting that timber. It was set aside specifically to fund schools. It was specifically set aside to fund roads. Yeah. And instead, we're spending money to watch trees burn, is essentially the environmental policy. I mean, just imagine if we spent just a little, you know, maybe a couple $1 million to manage those forests and instead open them to logging. I mean, instead of paying $1 billion to watch trees burn, we can earn millions in direct sales to the logging companies and billions more in revenue from all of the increased economic activity, including thousands of more jobs.
You hit it. You hit the nail on the head. The ONC counties, Oregon and California counties that in the 80s and 90s have made so much money for schools and infrastructure and security, law enforcement, public safety, that has been reduced down to a trickle. And that's why the south part of the state, west part of the state, is so economically challenged. We're living below the national poverty level. It shouldn't be. That shouldn't be with all these things that are available to us.
Well, in a lot of those counties, some of which we err in, they're down to almost no law enforcement. Josephine County famously made the news a few years back when they only had one sheriff for the entire county. And, you know, it's you know, it creates a real mess on a number of levels. Increased crime and whatnot as well. You know, we've talked a lot about financial issues. For people who haven't heard you before, what are some of the other areas that you want to focus on?
Well, of course, education. We need to get young people inspired. I want to change the culture in a lot of areas of Oregon. Education is one area that specifically needs to be plussed up on. And I think we can do that with including the trades training in every school. Starting the 10th grade, that's the grade that kids can drop out. And I don't want to see them discouraged and see no future ahead. And we can improve that by giving those opportunities for plumbing and electrical and auto mechanics and carpentry and even go out to computer repair and program design and things like that while still getting the core subjects, math, science, English. You know, press forward with those because you can't do the trades without understanding those areas. So you build a well-rounded young person that has an opportunity to make things and fix things and create. And we bring that to them in the 10th grade, and they're kind of interested. And they think, well, I think maybe I'm learning something here. I'm learning how to do something. And I'm proud of myself. You know, I'm changing my self-respect here. They won't say that, but that's essentially what's happened. And they go to the 11th grade. In 11th grade, they'll get even better. And then they'll say, well, you know, I'm going to go to 12th. And they graduate with this skill. And then they can go to college if they want, or they can get into the trades. And a big benefit of that is that industry looking for a state to settle in will look at Oregon and say, we have job-ready skills there. We don't have to go in and train people. People are there, and they're ready to go, and they're excited about it. So that's one area that I want to really hit hard is education. That's my number one priority.
Well, I definitely agree with you on that. And, you know, for a long time, people going into the trade, there was this stigma that, oh my gosh, you know, how did you not manage to go to college? You must be stupid or something like that. And a lot of that, frankly, was from our own governor, Governor Kitzhaber, who was trying to force kids to go into school rather than looking at the value of having a good paying job in the trades.
Right.
Just real quick,
right.
We've only got about 30 seconds here with you. Talk to us about what you would specifically want to change as far as leadership is concerned there in Salem.
I want to change accountability. I want to be transparent. I want to walk amongst the people and not stand in front of them. I want to hear their issues. I want to be, you know, a listening leader that then acts upon. I want the servant leadership that then acts upon what I'm hearing. I want to build trust within the state government. I want people to trust me, and I want to develop trust with them so that we can move forward in a positive way.
Well, trust is certainly missing. We have friends and family that work at the state, and that trust is definitely missing right now. Greg, I want to thank you so much for your time. He is once again running for Republican candidate for governor here in Oregon. His website, WooldridgeForOregon.com, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Greg, thanks again.
You're welcome. I had a great time. Talk to you soon.
Law enforcement officials across the country, even in California, are rejecting sanctuary laws that shield criminal aliens. In Oregon, the Stop Oregon Sanctuaries campaign is working to repeal the statute that makes Oregon a de facto sanctuary state. Your signature will help us get initiative petition number 22 on the 2018 ballot. Go to StopOregonSanctuaries.org and print your own petition. Then simply sign, date, and mail. It's that easy. Go to StopOregonSanctuaries.org. Do it today.
And welcome back. We just wrapped up with Greg Wooldridge, candidate for Republican candidate for governor here in Oregon. You have up until May 15th to vote for him. We're going to be talking now to Jeff Ferry. He is a research director at the Coalition for a Prosperous America. He's also an author and journalist, having written for the Washington Post, Forbes magazine, and Bloomberg News. He even produced some documentaries on business for the BBC and other British television broadcasters. Jeff, welcome to the show. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, Mark. It's great to be here.
So let's start by first getting to know a little bit about CPA. You're new to us and to our listeners as well. From your website, it says, Coalition for a Prosperous America is the nation's premier nonprofit organization working at the intersection of trade, jobs, tax, and economic growth. We are a bipartisan coalition of farmers and ranchers, manufacturers, and labor groups working for a national strategy to eliminate the trade deficit, create good-paying jobs, and deliver broadly shared prosperity to America. That sounds great. Eliminate the trade deficit, create good-paying jobs, and deliver prosperity. Okay, so how do you go about doing that?
Well, I think the trade deficit is the key and the best place to start. You know, last year, this country ran a $560 billion trade deficit. That's almost 3% of our GDP. And, our view is we think that eliminating the trade deficit and getting to balanced trade will make an enormous contribution to our economy.
Yes.
Because imports have hollowed out our manufacturing sector. And you know, I should add, this is a view that was very unpopular 10 years ago. You couldn't find a single economist or major politician who held this view 10, 15 years ago. Today, as you know, everything's changed. President Trump was elected in large part because he said, hey, trade is not a zero-sum game. It's a win-lose game, not always, but many times. And we've been losing too much with too many of our imported sectors and too many of our trading partners. And even on the Democratic Party side, you saw candidates saying trade is a problem and manufacturing decline is a problem. So the country is sort of moving our way and recognizing the importance of the trade issue.
Well, in terms of your other two issues, and just kind of give us an overview and we'll drill down into them in a little bit, but how do you go about creating good paying jobs? I mean, and then delivering prosperity, although, of course, if you do the first two, then the third one's going to follow. But how do you help promote creating good paying jobs?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's important to understand the link between trade, manufacturing, and jobs. I mean, the trade deficit is primarily concentrated in manufacturing goods. In fact, our goods deficit is larger than our overall deficit. Our goods deficit last year was $800 billion, and most of that is in manufacturing. And it's by losing these manufacturing sectors, whether we're talking about basic materials like steel and aluminum or advanced technology like semiconductors, we import today far more than we imported 10 or 15 years ago. And we've basically lost those jobs to the countries that are now producing those goods that we're importing. And, you know, the free trade economists will tell you that that's fine. Employees move to other jobs. Well, the fact of the matter is that some of those employees don't get other jobs. And
that's right.
The majority who do get other jobs get jobs in the service sector, which tend to be lower paying. So our solution is let's get fair trade across the world. Let's rebuild these manufacturing sectors. We will see people getting better jobs with better pay, better hours, and better benefits. And that will lead to prosperity, which can be measured in terms of a faster growth rate in the GDP.
Well, and I think you hit on the key point there is that we need fair trade, not necessarily just free trade. And we'll come back to that in a little bit. But in terms of one of the things that you consistently hear from these pundits is that, well, we just can't do manufacturing here in America anymore. Manufacturing's dead. And it's simply because these other countries pay their workers such a low hourly rate that we can never compete with that. So what's your response to that?
That is completely untrue. I mean, we are in a global market and we can and should trade, and some countries do other things better than we do. But, you know, Germany pays its workers better than ours, and their automobile sector is thriving. And as a result of the success of their automobile sector, their steel sector is doing well and other supply sectors are doing well. What we've done in this country, in the interests of the management and the stock market, we've said, you know, we can make a faster profit if we outsource as much as we can to foreign countries and just run these businesses for cash and for profit. And that's a very short-term point of view. What we need to do is to focus on them, is to make the climate right through fair trade and through other policies where the manufacturing sectors where we do have an advantage can grow instead of shrink. And there are many sectors where we have an advantage. You know, pure labor cost is only one part of the equation, and it's only a small part of the equation in many industries. In technology, labor costs are a minority. Why did the technology industry make a strategic decision to outsource all manufacturing around the year 2000? Well, the reason was that their profits collapsed because the internet boom collapsed. Mm-hmm. Really, we should be manufacturing the entire technology food chain here in the United States. That's just one example. There are other examples, too.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll have more with Jeff Ferry. He's the research director for the Coalition for a Prosperous America. You can find them on our website, iSpyRadio.com. We'll link them up. And coming up, we'll be talking about one company in Oregon that's about to do really well thanks to one of those tariffs against China. And welcome back. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Jeff Ferry of Coalition for a Prosperous America. They're the nation's premier nonprofit organization working at the intersection of trade, jobs, tax, and economic growth. Their website is prosperousamerica.org. They have three goals: eliminate the trade deficit, create good-paying jobs, and deliver broadly shared prosperity to America. I'd like to talk a little bit more in depth about tariffs and how they aren't always bad, despite what a lot of people may have heard from pundits and other media. You know, for those who don't quite understand how tariffs work, to the average Joe on the street, a computer is just a computer. They buy on price and also on features. But imagine if a Toshiba sales rep could sit outside a store, and every time a Dell computer truck pulled up, the Toshiba guy had the legal right to run over and slap a new price tag on the Dell computer that increased the price by 20%. To Joe on the street, I mean, which computer is he going to buy? He's going to buy the cheaper one usually. What Trump wants to do through this fair trade is to say, okay, if you're going to do that, China, fine, we're going to slap you with a price increase as well. The goal being to force an end to not just tariffs, but all predatory trade practices. And lo and behold, it's working. Right here in Oregon, you guys have an article up there about how California-based SunPower is buying Solar World Americas, which is based in Hillsboro, Oregon, and it was Trump's tariff that did that. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, you know, solar power is a good example of what we've seen from China in the last 20 years. I mean, frankly, free trade is great if every country obeys the rules. But what we've seen in the last couple of decades is a growth of countries that flout the rules, that pay no attention to the rules, that subsidize their products, dump products below cost here in the U.S., and it's all financed by government subsidies back home. And that hollows out and in some cases destroys American industry. And these can be strategic industries. And solar power is a great example, because solar power is a very strategic industry in the sense that we know it's going to grow over the next 20 years. It's only a couple of percent of American energy needs today, but clearly it's growing for several reasons. You know, there's environmental issues with oil and natural gas, even though we're in the midst of an oil boom in this country, there are still issues. And secondly, solar power is going to decline in costs because solar power is based on semiconductors. So it's an industry we want to be in. Unfortunately, China took the strategic decision about 10 years ago that it wanted to not just be in it, but dominate the world and sell to the rest of the world by using government subsidies to create uneconomic, artificially low prices. And, you know, they've been very successful. They now control 70% of solar cell manufacture worldwide. Hmm. And that's not a good situation for us economically, nor strategically from the national security point of view. So President Trump accepted the recommendation of the International Trade Commission in January and slapped 30% tariffs on solar panels and solar cells. Now, what's ironic about that whole debate that went on for the past year is one of the companies that opposed these tariffs most loudly and strenuously was a company called SunPower, based near where I live in San Jose, California. And SunPower said that this will never work. You can't use tariffs to make manufacturing work in America. Our costs are still way too high. Well, tariffs came in about 2 months ago. And then last week, as you mentioned, SunPower completely reversed itself and said, we're going to manufacture in the United States. We're going to buy a facility which was in decline and close to bankruptcy in Oregon, and we're going to rebuild it. And we think that's an absolutely fantastic result for the United States of America. I spoke to the CEO of SunPower last week and congratulated him on his strategic reversal and said everybody should be so flexible when necessary. And there's a little more to the story of what they're up to. But I think from the point of view of folks who live in Hillsboro, Oregon, the news could not be better. I mean, that's a good place to make semiconductor-based solar power systems, because it's already got that expertise. As you probably know, Intel's been in Oregon for a good 10 or 15 years, and there's a lot of expertise, skilled people, and knowledge and connections with local universities up there in Oregon. So it's a great solution, and it's an example. I think you said, you know, what about tariffs? I mean, you know, in an ideal world, we don't have any tariffs. But unfortunately, we don't live in that ideal world. We live in the real world. And it's not just China. There are many countries that are pursuing these policies that are saying, hey, we want to be in a strategic industry and we will use government support to get there. And so that faces the U.S. with a decision. And yeah, sometimes tariffs are the best answer.
They can be. And of course, that runs against what so many people have heard in the news, that tariffs are always supposed to be bad for trade. But of course, you know, if only one side is imposing those tariffs, it's bad for the other side. And it really is about getting that balance. But of course, you know, tariffs are only one small part of trade. From a CPA article that apparently had appeared on LifeSet, I'd like to read you this. In response to the president's tariffs, naive free trade pundits shout trade war, but they remain strangely mute about China's other predatory trade practices. Talk to our audience about some of those other predatory trade practices, and can you give us some examples?
Oh, well, you know, the one that's been in most in the news, I think, is IP theft, intellectual property theft. In other words, what China does, you know, China is very explicit that, you know, their president goes to Davos in Switzerland or comes to the U.S. and gives a big, fine speech about free trade. You know, when he speaks about democracy and freedom of speech, we all say, yeah, sure, we don't believe a word of it. You're a communist dictatorship and have been since 1949. I don't know why people believe him so much when he says we believe in free trade, because domestically what he says is there are certain industries where the Chinese must provide at least 70% of their own production. And in other industries, it's 100% and they want to be exporters. So they don't want free trade. They want to be self-sufficient. They regard the West as an enemy and a threat, and they pursue economic policies to follow. Now, the worst example of a policy, I think, is this forced technology transfer. For a company like Boeing or Intel to sell in China, the Chinese government tells them, you can't just sell here the way companies can sell in America. You must open a factory, you must have a joint venture partner in China, and you must share your technology with that partner.
Yes.
Well, as we all know, what that sharing leads to is what I call theft. In other words, that company learns from the American company how to make whatever it is they're making, whether it's a microchip or an airplane or a computer or a piece of machinery, and they don't pay the American company for what could have been 50 years of knowledge and expertise and millions of dollars in developing those techniques. And that's forced technology transfer. It's nominally forbidden by the World Trade Organization, but the World Trade Organization has no power to enforce its rulings, really.
That's what we're taking issue with. And it just seems absurd that American companies have done that. Coming back, we'll continue that thought with Jeff Ferry, Research Director at the Coalition for a Prosperous America. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Jeff Ferry. He is the research director at the Coalition for a Prosperous America. Their website is prosperousamerica.org. You know, fascinating discussion there in that last segment. And you were talking about how China forces these companies to share technology and this innovation and whatnot. I guess my question is, why? Why would some American company be willing to share their technological superiority?
That's a good question, and I think there you get into the problem with the short-termism of the American corporate sector.
Hmm.
You know, China is, I was just reading, for Boeing, China represents 20% of their sales, and that's pretty typical for a lot of large corporations now. China either is 20% of their sales today, or that's their goal, and it's a large country, as you know, a billion people, GDP of $12 trillion, and these companies do not want to ignore the China market. And so when China says to them, well, look, you can have significant sales in the next 2, 3, 4 years, as long as you agree to these forced technology transfers, they say to themselves and to their boards of directors, well, China won't be a serious threat in this business for 10 years. So let's go for it now. And we'll agree to whatever demands they have. And we'll get the benefits in the next couple of years. And that translates through to a stock price and all the other short-term indicators that corporate management cares about. And that's a problem for those of us who are thinking about the long-term future of the United States of America.
Oh, absolutely. That sounds so terribly short-sighted. And I'm sure a lot of it is, well, we're just going to increase our stock prices and everything will be happy. And maybe 10 years from now, we won't even be manufacturing that anymore. But you know, to be handing your competitor the keys to the lockbox there, that just seems crazy. We've only got about a couple minutes here with you. We've talked previously in other shows about the importance of blue collar jobs and skilled labor shortages and whatnot. Our previous guest, Greg Wooldridge, who was running for governor, said that that's going to be a major focus of his to build up our trade schools and get kids into these high-paying jobs that the future is going to need. With CPA's research, why is it what are you guys seeing? Why is it that kids aren't going into these trade schools? What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think he's right that that's a key issue. We need to train people for manufacturing jobs. And the key issue is at the end of the chain. I mean, you can't motivate young people to go study something if all around them they're hearing, well, that sector's in decline and there aren't so many jobs, or you might have to move 2,000 miles away to get a job. What we need to do is to stimulate those sectors so that there is demand, and so that young people are then motivated to go study those things. You know, it's like, imagine training a football team. You know, you can't train a bunch of kids to be great at football unless there are opportunities they can see in college and then beyond. And, you know, we have that system, and we have a great system when it comes to most sports, you know, through the schools and the farm leagues and then up to the major leagues. We need those major leagues here. So we need to take action to restore and rebuild some of these sectors, like solar power we were talking about, you know, machinery. I mean, there's lots of manufacturing sectors that need, you know, even automotive. Well, we've got a big automotive industry. It needs to be bigger. We need to see more manufacturing here. And that's because that is a very big, complex supply chain. If you make more cars, you need more machinery to make the bodies and the engines and all the other components. And then you need all those skills that go into making all those components. And that will translate back to the vocational schools. So, you know, I think at the level of governor in Oregon, you know, they can't really be talking too much about federal policies because they're state officials. So I think it sounds like the gentleman you're talking about, and I don't know him personally, sounds like he's on the right track. I think we need to encourage young people to think about manufacturing and think about vocational skills. We don't want to send everybody to a four-year college, you know, to study medieval literature and get out and be unemployed.
No, absolutely not. And isn't it ironic that the kids going through the trade school are paying the taxes that will keep those people on unemployment? Jeff Ferry, he is with Coalition for a Prosperous of America. We're definitely going to have you back. This has been a great discussion. Look forward to talking to you again.
Same here. Thanks a lot for having me. I enjoy talking to you.
You can follow me on Twitter. I am at iSpyRadio. That's the letter I, at iSpyRadio. And I do follow back. Do be sure to check this week's show page on iSpyRadio.com. Great articles on today's topics, links to Jeff's group, Coalition for a Prosperous America. We also have links to Greg Wooldridge's campaign site, Twitter, and Facebook page. And you can see that Newt Bueller flyer for yourself, all in one place, so you can make good decisions for the primary. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a faith that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.
I'm Sam Carpenter, and I'm running for governor of Oregon because I've watched our magnificent state suffer through three decades of failed progressive far-left leadership. Businesses are choked by high taxes and too many regulations. Our schools are failing, and our forests are burning. The streets of Portland are no longer charming. They're scary. And our government is out of control with reckless spending on failed social experiments instead of serving the people. It's high time to give a voice to the forgotten families of Oregon who want their children to get a great education. It's high time to bring common sense back to the management of our natural resources. And it's high time to create powerful economic opportunity in every corner of Oregon. As your governor, I'll lift the jackboot of too much government, and I'll give power back to the everyday people who live here. I'm Sam Carpenter, and I approve this message. Join me, and let's make Oregon great again.
Paid for by friends of Sam Carpenter.